Hello and welcome to the Habitcast, Habitat Pinellas and West Pasco's new show highlighting our mission, our partners, and our homeowners. I'm your host, Morgan Brochetti, and I'm here with my co-host, Mike Sutton. Hey, Mike.
What's going on, Morgan? How are you?
How are you? Good.
I'm good.
This week, you're celebrating a big anniversary.
Today is my seven-year anniversary here at Habitat. Official seven.
Congratulations.
I kind of have a couple anniversaries. One, when I signed my offer letter, so that was in February, but this is my real, like my first start date. I walked in, I don't know how happy everyone was that I was here. I had no computer for about 2 weeks, no guidance or anything. I didn't even know where the bathroom was, but I figured out and made it work.
It must have been a good onboarding because you're still here, so.
Still hanging out.
Well, congratulations on your 7 years.
Thank you. Yeah. It's been fun.
So we are having a very special guest on today. I'm really excited to have our viewers kind of meet virtually Jonathan Reckford.
Yeah. What's cool about Jonathan, so, you know, before working here at Habitat Pinellas West Pasco, I was with a Habitat organization in Texas. Mm-hmm. And during that time is when Jonathan started with Habitat International. And he's done a phenomenal job. He's one of the most humble gentlemen that I've ever met. So he probably would deflect the credit, but he has done just such a phenomenal job leading our organization and really taking it from kind of a founder, you know, that ran the organization for a number of years, 20 mm-hmm. plus years, to a place where it's professionalized, it's grown, and the numbers of families and individuals served on an annual basis is just phenomenal. So cool that he's taken some time to visit with us today, because we know he's busy. You know, Habitat Absolutely. International has programs in 70 plus countries, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's over 1,100 affiliates across the country. So we know that they're busy, but he carved out a few minutes to chat with us today. So it's exciting.
Yeah, very exciting. And I know one of the things we're going to talk about is just keeping people engaged. Mm-hmm. So I want to thank our viewers who are tuning in now and who have watched previous episodes. Watching the Habitcast is one way to get involved. You can get social with us on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, all the above. While we don't have volunteers on site right now, there are still other ways you can still get engaged with the mission. And I know we'll chat a bit more with him on that as well, which is great.
Yeah.
And one of those ways.
We also have dedications coming up on Saturday.
I was going to say, if you're going to be up and about in the morning on Saturday, we have three really exciting dedications coming up. So that's our men's build, our women's build, and then we have another family, the Dorseys, who are going to be receiving their keys.
Back to back to back. It'll be
back
fun.
Back to back. That's how we
9:30, 10 o'clock. No better way to start your Saturday morning. So tomorrow, come out, join us. It'll be awesome. And if you can't join us, you can also watch them on Facebook. Mm-hmm. We'll have them on Facebook Live. So folks will be able to tune in. Short 10-minute ceremony, but it's really neat. And kind of a positive and a challenge for us. You know, we've talked about how volunteers can't work on homes right now, and our homeowner candidates, the same thing. So for a lot of the families, the very first time they're seeing their house and the inside of their house is when they're getting their keys. So right. It does create a kind of a little bit more of a unique experience when they do walk through, you know, the front door for the first time. So there's not usually a dry eye. If you do come out, I recommend you wear sunglasses. So
absolutely,
that's what I do. Then people don't see the tears. So I hide them.
That's the way to do it. So either way, if you can join us in person, great. If not, tune in on Facebook. And it's a great way to start your Saturday. Let's jump into our conversation with Jonathan. I'm really excited to have him on.
Sounds good.
Let's do it.
All good. Jonathan, thank you for being with us today. We know you've you have a extremely busy schedule, so we appreciate you finding some time to chat with us.
My pleasure, Mike. It's great to be with you. I wish it could be in person.
Hopefully soon. We were talking a little bit offline earlier that hopefully we're turning a corner here and things get back to whatever that normal looks like rather quickly, you know. So it's been a challenging year.
Sure has.
Absolutely.
So, Jonathan, I think a lot of the folks that will watch this are probably intrigued about kind of your background and what brought you to Habitat. And Habitat, I think what's interesting in our 40 plus years of being in existence is we've only had three CEOs, right? And one of those was kind of more of an interim. But you've been with Habitat for quite a while now, but mm-hmm. can you tell us a little bit about how you got to Habitat and what that looked like?
Well, I think the easiest explanation is God has a sense of humor, but it is, my career never made any sense to me, but I look back and all the pieces have turned out to be incredibly helpful for Habitat. I could never keep a job, and now this is year 16 here, but I can honestly say there is nothing I would rather be doing. And so it was, you know, an unexpected journey, I would certainly say. Coming out of college, I thought I was going to go into law school and go into politics. Suddenly realized I had no interest in being a lawyer. Talked my way into a job at Goldman Sachs, despite being a poli-sci and English major, and then suffered mightily for the hubris of saying I would learn finance faster than they could teach people how to communicate. Also realized, though I learned a lot, I wasn't really destined to be an investment banker. And so had a couple of inflection points. The first one was, rather than going straight to grad school, was lucky enough to have a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation and spent a year in South Korea. And that was a transformational year for my personal faith, but also just in the pre-internet age, being completely away from everything that was familiar. And I spent a year doing marketing work for the Olympic Organizing Committee for the 88 Seoul Olympics. And then in a longer story I won't tell, coaching the Korean rowing team, sort of like the Jamaican bobsled team. But I came out of that year really interested in nonprofit work and really interested in the idea long-term of doing something mission or ministry driven, mm-hmm. but realized I needed to learn skills. And there were only a couple of business schools back then that believed we needed professional management of nonprofits, which is funny because now that's such a mainstream idea. Mm-hmm. But back then, Stanford and Yale were the only ones. And so went to Stanford and got an MBA, but with a focus in nonprofit and public management. And then there weren't a lot of tracks straight into the nonprofit world. So had the idea there, I'll go into the business world, learn the skills, and then eventually bring those across to a mission that matters. And so ended up working in mostly entertainment and hospitality, first with Marriott and then Disney, helping start new businesses for them. And then was head of strategy for Circuit City. Sadly, now dead back then, they were the top retailer. And they were starting CarMax, which I thought was fascinating. And it's one of the things that drew me, which was going to disrupt the way cars were being sold. Yeah. And then was recruited to be president of a company called Musicland, which another, sad, this is my business credibility completely shot since they are gone as well. But back then, they were the leading specialty retailer of music and movies and 1,400 stores. Wow. And then Best Buy bought Musicland. And at that point, I thought, you know, I've been in the business world longer than I had planned. And so maybe it's time to make the leap. And I did what I usually encourage people not to do, which is I left not knowing what I was going to do next. And I went on this was my next big inflection point, went on a mission trip to India and serving with the Bungi in central India. And among the, you know, those who are sort of left out in the world, the Bungi are at the bottom of the bottom of the caste system, where they are literally only allowed to hand clean latrines and clean up dead animals and aren't allowed to live in communities in the rural areas. And it just broke my heart. And it sort of all those latent social justice feelings kind of came back up. And I came back from that, not knowing what I was going to do, but pretty clear that now I really wanted to spend my time focused on poverty alleviation and turned down some good business opportunities and almost got some nonprofit jobs. But both cases, they hired somebody who'd already run a nonprofit. And that led to a long waiting period. And it was frustrating from an ego perspective. It was great from a family perspective. What I really heard, a couple things that were, you know, were tough, but really important. One is, I had a sense that God cared more about my character than my job. So I had some work to do internally. And second, if I'm honest, and it's a little embarrassing, you know, my deal was, God, I'll do anything you want as long as it meets my geographic, family, ego gratification, and all my other wants. And sure. I had to get to the point where, best as I could, it was, okay, God, no conditions. And as I went through that, to my surprise, as I'd worked in the business world to help grow companies, my volunteer work had been helping grow churches, and my church, local church in Minneapolis, had exploded and asked if I would come serve as the executive or sort of administrative pastor for what had become a very large church. And everyone I trusted for career advice said, you know, don't do it. This is a bad idea. But as Ashley and I prayed about it, we really had a sense this is what we were supposed to do. And it was, and I really do think this is a God thing. So just as I made that decision, got a call from a headhunter at one of the big search firms talking to me about an internet retailer. And I remember saying, you know, that sounds like an amazing opportunity. I'm going to go work for my local church, thinking I will, you know, never hear from you again, off the radar. And I was happily working away at our church 2 years later, not looking, when that same headhunter called up out of the blue and said, Jonathan, do you know anybody who'd be interested in Habitat for Humanity? And I remember just the adrenaline going down my back and just a long pause. I said, does it have to be somebody famous? And I, you know, like most people, I thought Jimmy Carter ran Habitat and started it. And I didn't know why he was retiring. And so, and they said, no, you know, actually the founder has been pushed out and they are looking for sort of to the next stage of growth. And so I went home and wrote this very passionate letter saying, I don't know if, you know, I'm the right person, but I believe this is the kind of thing that I have been preparing for all my life. And to my great, that was April of 05. And to my great surprise by, you know, July, this was real. So it has been, and this has been just a, not easy, but a joy to be part of.
Well, it's been amazing to see Habitat's growth during your time with the organization. Mm-hmm. I was working for a Habitat affiliate in Texas back starting in 04. So I was, you know, with Habitat when you came in as the new CEO. And that's a challenge going from a founder, right, that had been with the organization for 20 plus years to someone who is really coming in to kind of shift and change culture and really grow the organization to ensure there's a larger and wider impact, you know, across the world. So, and you've done a fabulous job with that.
Oh, thank you. Well, it takes everybody. And it's, as you know, better than everyone, it is, we are a large and complex family across the world. But I do think, which gets me so excited, we've seen real buy-in in a way to a radical change in our frame, which is not, and it wasn't a bad question. In some ways, our core before was how many houses can we build? And that's hugely important. We want to build more than ever. But I think moving to this idea of what would it take for Habitat to meaningfully help reduce the housing deficit in all of our communities is a sort of scarier question, but has pushed us into advocacy, pushed us into you know, a broader leadership role of being part of the broader housing community in a way. I think we're seeing incredible fruit from that. And so we're still doing, I think, that core work that people love about Habitat, but we're amplifying that with a broader influence that's allowing us to help far more people.
So when you look at your work on a, you know, kind of a normal, in a normal world, right, before COVID, in terms of percentage wise, I mean, are you spending a great deal of your time and energy internationally versus nationally?
You know, I do. It's a mix still, though we're working to change it over time. The majority of the funds for the world are still coming out of the US, though we're raising much more in Asia and Europe than we used to, and some in Latin America. So in some ways, and the US is unique because we have such a big footprint here too, with our 1100 plus affiliates across the United States. And so it's divided. I would say my time, I don't have a good ratio. I probably, the growing ratio is more and more external time in terms of both fundraising and advocacy and policy work. And I try to combine. So that's where it's a little harder. So if I'm in a country or visiting, you know, there, I often will try to do a mix of advocacy work, working, meeting with partners, as well as visiting the local work and getting to know the Habitat work at a more direct level. And so trying to mix together a bit. But it is, what certainly is true is our international work has grown really fast and started to scale in some ways. And some of that are new areas that I'm really excited about. And it's an and, because we're still growing our core work, but some of the work that's been really fun to see explode, and I actually think is now needed more in the US, has been our market development work, where we're trying to make the market work better for low-income families so they can actually improve their own housing. So we became a leader in housing microfinance and trying to convince the microfinance industry to make small home improvement loans to very, very low-income families who weren't considered creditworthy by banks. And we've seen that now impacting millions of families a year. And now I'm really excited. We have a Shelter Venture Lab where we are co-investing and training entrepreneurs who are coming up with better building products for low-income families, again, to lower barriers. And then our advocacy work is focused on property rights primarily, because in so many places, women and other marginalized groups may have lived in somewhere for a very long time, but not have the legal right to stay. And if you don't know that you can stay, then it's not rational to take out a loan or start working on improving your house. But I would now argue in the US, we have market failure. You know, now the market is incapable of providing enough housing for low and even moderate income families right now in the US. So Habitat needs to build more than ever. But I actually think that same approach of what would it take with the nonprofit, the home builders and developers and the cities to kind of come together and say, how do we meaningfully increase the supply of housing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's interesting you say that. So here in Pinellas County, one of the two counties in which we serve, it's the most densely populated county in the southeastern United States. So it's a peninsula on a peninsula, right?
Right.
So there was an article in the newspaper the other day that stated, again, almost a million people living in Pinellas County. There's less than 600 homes available on the market. And so our market is so out of whack right now, which is just causing prices to continue to increase. Land is getting so out of whack that an organization like Habitat, we're competing with for-profit builders to acquire property. And we know that at Habitat International, you guys launched the Cost of Home program as a way to really help, you know, the advocacy component of ensuring that there's adequate affordable housing, and that organizations like Habitat have an opportunity to be able to provide that. Mm-hmm. So how did Cost of Home come about, and how have you seen the impact of that, you know, really kind of, I guess, help the affordable housing crisis?
You know, it started, we've been doing advocacy for a long time. And it was interesting, even back, you know, Mike, when you and I joined, advocating on behalf of those in need of decent shelter was actually a core principle of Habitat. But there was also a practical ethos which said Habitat doesn't deal with government. We're going to stay independent on government. As we wrestled with that, we said, you know, the real principle is we don't want to be dependent on government. And I actually really agree with that principle. But you can't solve housing without partnering with government. There's no example of that in the world. And so that was the beginning of our formal advocacy work. And then what, about 4 years ago, 4.5 years ago, we launched Solid Ground, our first ever global advocacy campaign that was really focused heavily on property rights. And we did that in about 40 countries. And we were really encouraged. We saw that ultimately impacted about 12 million people that we were able to help get property rights or significant change in their status for housing. Mm-hmm. And based on that and the growing need that you just identified in the US, we felt the time was right to do our first ever US campaign. And I thought we thought about what is unique about Habitat. So there is a federal component, absolutely. But Cost of Home is actually an umbrella of 330 local and state campaigns. And I think that's what's critical, because the reality is so much of housing is local. It's zoning and how land use is decided is so critical, though there's obviously also the funding component. And that's where state and federal are a huge piece as well. And I think Florida has been a good example. If you think about the SHIP funds, that was an example where Habitat played a leadership role in that. A very recent example of Cost of Home is we did our first ever virtual Habitat on the Hill, where instead of having everybody gather in Washington, we did it virtually. That allowed us to have twice as many people participate, but we were still able to meet with 400 of members of Congress, which was pretty powerful. And in the five meetings I had, I was really struck that the meeting still worked and that housing is actually becoming more visible, maybe because it's actually become such a crisis now. So what I've been hearing from members of Congress is they are now hearing about it from their constituents in a way that they didn't before. But a very tangible example of that is in the original stimulus bill, there was rental assistance for low-income families who'd lost their jobs through no fault of their own due to COVID to help them. But there was nothing for low-income homeowners, which made no sense to us. So we pushed very hard. And in fact, then in the final bill, there is assistance for low-income homeowners as well, because the worst possible thing would be for a family to lose their home, lose the asset they have invested so much in, because, again, of conditions they couldn't control if they worked in a service industry or worked in an area. And, of course, lower-income families are disproportionately not knowledge workers. So they have been more prone to being in entertainment, hospitality, service in ways that were at risk. So we have seen mm-hmm. some really good victories at the local level around zoning changes, around state housing finance level, and some at the federal level. But what you've identified is, I think, the challenge facing us in the US, which is we're really seeing an asset bubble again, low interest rates. Yeah. And ironically, in most recessions, housing prices go down. COVID mm-hmm. uniquely has actually driven prices up. So you've got too much cash, which is pushing real estate assets up. At the same time, people want more living space because of the having to work from home. So we're seeing people pushing out. That means lumber has tripled in cost, as you know well. It means land prices have skyrocketed, and even labor costs have gone up for skilled labor, which is in short supply. So it is, I think we need people of goodwill to all kind of band together and say, we can do better than this. And, you know, we can't have, you know, Florida historically has been very affordable, which has been part of that growth. You mm-hmm. don't want Florida to look 15 years ahead and become California, where only rich people can kind of live in a city. And that's not sustainable. That's not going to work from a societal or, you know, either practically or ethically. That's not a great model for our future.
Yeah. Yeah, we're seeing probably a 15 to 20% increase on cost of each house that we do. So it's unsustainable. But I do think that one of the things that this kind of what we're experiencing right now has done is it's forced our staff to be more innovative and creative in our approach. And so, again, coming off of a year where we built a record number of homes, we were able to do that because the municipalities in which we work in, partner with Habitat. You know, they look at it like it's a true partnership. What do we need to do to kind of keep moving that ball down the court? And so, but it does present the challenge. So we'll keep working at it. And we know HFHI is leading the way with some of that advocacy work. So let's transition real quick and talk a little bit about, with all the traveling you do, and all the different countries you've been in, you know, Habitat's in 70 plus countries around the world. Give us a couple examples of maybe your favorite places to visit. And then maybe, you know, what's one of those unique mission moments that really sticks out in your mind?
You know, it's always so hard to pick favorites, but if you'll indulge me a little storytelling, you know, I think there are a few that are sort of indelibly marked for me. My first one is, I think, will always be resonant because it was my first bill with President Mrs. Carter. And, you know, I was joking before, everyone thinks they started and ran Habitat, which is not true, but there's no question, you know, they put Habitat on the map. And I'm not sure Habitat would have ever become what it is without the Carters. And they are such amazing servant leaders in terms of the role models they are for all of us. So this was 2006. I came in just too late to go on the 05 build in Michigan. And we went to Lonavala, India, where President Carter's mother, so Miss Lillian, had served in the Peace Corps at age 70 in India. And so we went there in a way to honor the community where she had served. And it was wonderful. It was a group of 100 women who were going to be the homeowners, which was a whole social statement in itself. Mm-hmm. And they had put in all their time together and built this extraordinary community. And we built 50 duplexes, so 100 homes that week. Very hot, very wet, and just joyful. And I think one of the things that struck me is it was my first Carter build, and I think we had 21 nationalities working on our duplex. So you had this amazing sense of the world coming together. And at the dedication, I'll never forget two images that I held on to. One is just before we dedicate our home, I sat down with a group of Pakistani and Indian students who had spent the week building together. And all they could talk about is what they had in common, where they had been raised to think of each other as, you know, the enemy. And they said, you know, we look alike, we speak alike, we dress alike. And they just talked about how much they had learned, about how much they shared. And then at the dedication ceremony, one of the husbands of our new homeowners got up and he put his arm around his new neighbor who across the wall. And his name was Aziz, and he put his arm around Subhash, his neighbor, and he said, you know, we are from different faiths, one Muslim, one Hindu, a big social barrier in India, and we're from different castes in India, for those who know, even a bigger social barrier. He said, but now we're brothers. And this experience of coming together with Habitat and building had not only changed their view of what Christians were like, but it changed their view even of their own neighbors in a way that has lasted. And I've gotten to see sort of track the families over the years, and the community and the families are just thriving. But it was an image, even though Habitat's all about building houses, that intangible side of Habitat is in some ways what really pulls my heart and what pulled me into the mission in the first place.
It's amazing in a world that is so divided, right? Religious beliefs and political beliefs and such. The one thing that I love about Habitat is that you could be swinging a hammer next to somebody who thinks completely different than you, and you can create a bond and you put all that stuff aside to help a family in need, right? It's the theology of the hammer.
Absolutely. And I do think what service is really part of the answer to our kind of breakage in our society, because I do believe when people serve together, they're focused on their common values, whereas the media and everything else in social media are engines of discontentment and separation. And I think desperately we need to create more vehicles for relationship building and bridge building. And I think service is really the best way to do that. And I've seen sort of remarkable. And one of the biggest barriers is economic. We're increasingly becoming an economically divided society. And then Habitat is one of those rare ways. And President Carter talks about it all the time, that he has said, and I quote, "Habitat is the best way I know to put my faith into action in a practical way." But he also then talks about how it's one of those rare chances where people with means can really build relationship and work side by side, people without. And that goes all the way back to our founding. And that sense of true partnership, and goodness knows we need more of that right now. Yeah. I'll tell when I think about heart mission, I think the most powerful experience I've had, and if you have families out there, maybe you'll resonate. It's when I've taken my kids on international builds for Habitat, and I think about, I'll tell the short version, but I took my oldest, my son Alexander. And we went to Zambia, was his first build. And then he went on a bunch more. But we were building with the Piri family in Zambia. And, you know, when you just think about need, I do think we can lose, you know, in the U.S., even our, even folks in need, it's all relative. And the Piris had 9 people living in a tent. Mr. Piri and 3 of the family members had tuberculosis. The conditions were just totally unacceptable. And then this was what was so moving. You know, the HIV/AIDS crisis was rampant across sub-Saharan Africa, and Mr. Piri's brother died. So with 9 people in the tent, they took in 4 nieces and nephews. So now they had 13. And then Mr. Piri's son befriended a boy named Gift, who had been essentially abandoned. His mother had disappeared. His father had abused him terribly. He ended up on the street, and they took him in. So here's a family with almost nothing by material means, and they take in a boy, and Gift and my son worked together all week digging and then building a latrine, and this is just a beautiful young man, and it was and I just think about, you know, the lessons in sort of generosity and community and engagement for a family that you know, certainly by material means we would say is the least of these, but had so much dignity and grace and compassion in a way, as, you know, as I think I came home and, you know, our kids are stressed over sharing a bathroom, you know, it's all relative, right?
It's all relative.
And then similarly, a few years later, I got to take my youngest Lily to Cambodia, which is a place that has really touched my heart. I've been there now at least 6 times, I think. And it is, you know, back then, I think the median income for the whole country was $1.23 a day. So this is really, you know, the median income was below the global poverty line for extreme poverty, and such a tragic history. And we were building alongside a woman named Soy Lorne, who is, we're building a home where she could live with her mother and her 2 children. And again, just heartbreaking. We have a subset of our global work is for orphans and vulnerable groups, where we are working with people who have faced real devastation. And that could be a disaster, a natural disaster, but could be a man-made disaster or health disaster as well. And in this case, again, really tough conditions. She and her family were living in a garbage dump in Phnom Penh. And it's one of the worst places I've ever, no human being should live in the conditions they were living. But then her husband died, and they couldn't even afford the rent on this shack over a sewage pit. And and they were end up on the street. And so through partnership, Habitat was partnering with them. And, you know, I was so struck. Lily was about the same age as her daughter, Colab, which means Rose. You had Rose and Lily, but Lily was, you know, from nutrition and everything else, a good foot taller. And we built together with them. And I love the dedication moment. You may have a photo of that, but it was in the summer in Cambodia, you get these typhoon-like storms that just roll in and roll out. And the night before, Soylong had told us there had been a big storm during the night. She had literally been standing up all night. So she was exhausted, holding their little tarp together to try to protect the few belongings they had in there. So we usually want everything to be perfectly finished before a family can move in. But in this case, given the conditions, said they could move right in while we did the final finish. So we had just attached the wooden shutters onto the house, and the inside was finished, the exterior, very simple one-room house. And then just as we're about to do the dedication, the storm just, you could see it just rolling in, and the rain started coming down, and she very graciously invited us into her home to do an indoor dedication. And we, and I remember sitting, and the rain just starts beating down, and I watched her and I watched her mom, and they're looking up to see, as the rain's beating down, is any of the water going to come in? And then of course, as a volunteer, I'm like, oh, please don't have any water come in. So I'm nervous too. And then it was so powerful. I just saw their shoulders kind of relax, they just sort of smiled. And it was such a reminder that maybe for the first time they were safe. And we often don't think about physical safety and how much that matters to a home, but now they were going to have access to water and sanitation. Colab and her brother were going to be able to go to school for the first time. You know, all the things that come with a house, and you think about transformation. And I was back in Cambodia a few years later, and I wasn't able to get it. I was too far. I didn't have time to take an extra day to go out and visit, which I was disappointed by. But I got an update on how she's doing. And now, as a property owner, she had remarried. Kids are in school. Her income has quintupled. So she's making five times as much now. And the family is stable. And it's just
stability.
You think about all the things that we take for granted. And a house obviously isn't the only thing anybody needs, but it is the foundation. And if you take out that foundation, almost a prerequisite, then you don't get health and education and self-sustaining families. So it is, but it was, that's indelibly marked. And of course, for my kids to see that and understand, what it is that was getting me on all these airplanes, and to feel a little bit of personal ownership of the mission.
Absolutely. And I think that sigh of relief that you mentioned, that's what I think our volunteers are missing the most right now. So we have been without volunteers on site for over a year now. And we talked a little bit about this offline, but that means homeowner candidates, volunteers, our sponsors. But seeing that sigh of relief and having that tangible action of being able to help provide that stability, it's a huge part of what's missing now. So we are hoping, sooner rather than later, we can get volunteers back on site to help continue to make that impact. But I know that many of them are chomping at the bit to get back out there for sure.
So agree, Morgan. And selfishly, it's what sort of fires me up all over again every time I get to go out into the communities and both see the need, but also see the difference we're able to make. Mm-hmm. And I know so many volunteers feel that way as well. And we, of course, had to put the health of the communities and safety ahead of our desires. But I am desperately eager to, when we can, bring everybody back out again. And I think at a time where obviously the need is greater than ever. We had a housing crisis before COVID. And to our volunteers, I would just say, remember that construction isn't the only way to volunteer. And I know so many of you are, but you can volunteer with our stores, you can advocate, you can learn more about the broader housing need and get involved. There are just a ton of ways to engage. In addition, you can go raise money, which is always needed, and be a part of the mission in other ways. So while we can't do construction right now with you, please do engage, because the issues of housing are really becoming a true crisis. The places that used to be affordable have become ridiculous, but the places, Atlanta, where I live, used to be very affordable. Now that's really not true anymore. I know in Pinellas, we were just talking about it, land has accelerated. And so Historically, Florida was a place where housing was largely very affordable. There was an ample supply. Now what we're seeing is the supply can't nearly keep up with demand, and that is squeezing out low and moderate income families. And so it is there's an urgency to what we do now.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Well, as we finish up here, Jonathan, again, thank you for being with us. But we've been ending these podcasts with our guests, asking them, you know, what does home mean to you? So share with us, when you think of the word home, what does that mean?
You know, for me, home is much more than walls and a roof. It's that literal foundation and launching pad. You know, I think about the stability I had growing up because I lived in the same house, you know, my whole life, and took that for granted. And I think in Arabic, bayt means home, and it's much more than a physical structure. It's actually identity. Home is about your identity, from which you can go out into the world and serve and grow into all that God intends. And so I think home is a sacred space.
Awesome. Absolutely. Well, Jonathan, thank you for your leadership, and thank you for continuing to, you know, advance the Habitat mission despite the pandemic and the COVID crisis. We thank you for everything that you do, and thank you for taking some time to visit with Morgan and I. It really means a lot that you took some time to visit with us today.
Well, thanks to both of you, and thank you for the great work that you're doing locally. It is that's where the real action is. And for those who don't know, Habitat is made up of a wonderful family of local affiliates all over the United States, and then country programs all over the world. And by definition, so please, if you're watching, go out and connect with your local affiliate and help start solving all the challenges, but also be part of the beauty and joy that we've been talking about. It's been great to be with you both.
Awesome. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thanks, Jonathan.
That was a great experience, great opportunity to chat with Jonathan and just kind of hear from his perspective, you know, what things have been like going through the pandemic, but at the same time, how Habitat continues to address the need for affordable housing in not only in our area, not only throughout the United States, but throughout the world. So really exciting to hear that things keep moving forward. So Jonathan's a great leader.
Mm-hmm. I really appreciate his stories with his mission moments and involving his kids. That is so cool to hear his kids have built alongside other kids from, like he told in one of his stories. There are so many barriers, but when you're building a home and you get to work alongside somebody who has the same needs as you, it really changes your perspective. So to hear that from an early age is really cool. And hearing about that sigh of relief, like I said, that's something that our volunteers and our sponsors and everybody in the community who partners with Habitat gets to experience on the build site or off. But knowing that you're a part of that sigh of relief that eventually comes for that homeowner is huge.
You know, it's interesting. He, you know, obviously talked about global experiences of interacting with folks from different countries. Mm-hmm. When I took a trip with some of our team to Nicaragua a couple of years ago, I was blown away by the bond that we created with the homeowner floor, despite the fact that I didn't speak the same language or anything, but just the communication you would have body language wise, and just being, you know, working together, right? Passing block or laying, you know, block. It was amazing that bond that was created. So, and I think that's what Habitat's all about. It brings people together from different backgrounds and different faiths and different, you know, political thoughts and that kind of thing. And we're all able to build together. So it's pretty amazing.
Absolutely. And so, like we always say, you know, we can't have volunteers on the build site right now, but there are plenty of other ways to get involved with Habitat. So tuning into the Habitcast is a great way. Tuning into those dedications, we have three tomorrow, which is super exciting. Check out the website. You can look at our calendar and see any upcoming events or dedications as well. That's a great way to get involved. Shop the restores, donate the restores. There are so many ways that you can still help a family move forward towards affordable home ownership right now that we would love for you to get involved. And we've always said, you know, reach out to us too. Any Habitat staff would be happy to help you get plugged in. The more the merrier.
Exactly. Well, thank you for joining us today. Please share the Habitcast with others, and encourage them to watch. It's a great way for us to kind of help the community understand the importance of affordable housing, but also the work that Habitat's doing throughout our community. And we could not do that without you. So thank you for taking the time. Morgan, it's always a pleasure. I'll let you get back to work. I'm going to go read the newspaper and take a nap.
Hey, it's your anniversary week. You can do whatever you want.
Thank you. I appreciate that. All right. Thank you all so much for being with us.